Welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is one of Australia's most beloved comic performers, best known for her roles in Fast Forward, Babe, and Kath and Kim. And now she's written Australia's Book of the Year. But Reckoning is not a comedy. It's a memoir about growing up in suburban Melbourne, coming to terms with her sexuality and learning the dark history of her family. Magda Sibanski, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Hi, thank you.
Did I say your name right?
Well, in Polish it would be Magdalena Szubańska, but, you know, Szubański is, yeah, basically. Well, basically, completely phonetic as all the Polish is.
Welcome to England, I want to say. Although, actually,
Welcome home, really.
Exactly, because you were born here, weren't you?
I was, yeah, and I very much identify with that part of myself. It's really funny. I was only five when I left, but, you know, my sister was 15, my brother was 13, so... You know, they were very English, so I grew up in a very English kind of, you know, British bubble. So, yeah, I love it. I come here and immediately I'm having Yorkshire pudding and I feel very at home.
You were born on an auspicious day.
I was, the day that Yuri Gagarin went up into space, as my parents would say every time they mentioned it. 12th of April, 61, yeah. So, yes, whether it's been auspicious for me, I don't know. Or the world, really, who knows?
I think this is one of the best opening lines of a novel I have ever read. I mean, forget Austen, forget Orwell. So it reads, "If you had met my father, you would never, not for an instant, have thought he was an assassin." What an extraordinary line.
Actually, the editor put that there. It was a few pages on, and I think I would have been too shy to... I was very conscious of not trying to sensationalise my father's experience, but that is actually the truth. And, yeah, it's a rip-snorter of an opening line, isn't it? And it tells you everything, especially because in Australia I'm very known for comedy, and this is just not a funny book. It's not a celebrity book. I could, like, care less about celebrity. It's really a book about intergenerational trauma, to be honest. And that immediately lets people know what they're in for, because I don't want people forking out their money thinking they're going to have a very different kind of ride. And it's not that it's devoid of humour, but it's very much about the impact, the rolling on impact of my father's experiences during the Second World War, where he was an assassin in a top secret counterintelligence unit in Warsaw, working for the Polish resistance, killing Polish collaborators and hiding Jewish people. So, and, you know, after years of therapy, it all just kind of poured out of me, really. So... That's when you end up with a sentence like that.
Which, as you say, absolutely isn't a lie, and that the book unfolds around the truths of your father's life. So can we start with the biographical details that we know, not just about him, but about your mother too?
Yeah. Well, my father was born in Poland in 1924. My mother was born in Scotland in 1924. My father came from quite a middle-class, comfortably off family. My mother came from a working-class Scottish, Irish Catholic family in just north of Edinburgh in Dunfermline. And my father, when he was 15, Hitler invaded Poland, and immediately he and his entire family became involved in the resistance. And from very early on, they were helping to hide Jewish people. And then he was officially recruited into the unit when he was 19 in 1943. And then he fought in the Warsaw Uprising in 44, escaped through a sewer, which is a horrific story in itself, was captured, cattle trucked to a POW camp, where he was eventually liberated by the Russians and then made his way to Britain, and that's how he met my mum. Mm-hmm. So, and then all of us kids were born here in Britain. And then in 1965, he had studied medicine at Edinburgh University, and then they cancelled the course. They had a special Polish branch, but they cancelled the course, and so he went and studied textiles. And we were flying out. We weren't part of the – everyone thinks we're like 10-pound poms, you know, because that was such a thing then, and everyone else was, but – which shows you how you can be – you have to read history carefully for those sort of, you know, anomalies. But, yeah, we were flown out. He worked for a subsidiary of ICI, and he was a textile – sort of like a textile technologist, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Early in the book, when you think you might want to be a doctor, you've already moved to Melbourne, and your mother burns herself quite badly, and you beg to see the wound. And your father's very detached and professional, and you write, "It was an early hit of intergenerational Novocaine to the heart. My sentimental education in the art of pinnacle disassociation had begun." For me, that's absolutely the heart of the book, isn't it?
Spot on. Yeah, no one's picked that up before, and that is spot on. That's absolutely what it was. My father, the other way I describe it is that in order to survive that war, he had to perform a kind of an emotional triage and just jettison every feeling that wasn't necessary to survival. And, it, you know, when you sort of shut down feelings, it's a blunt instrument. You know, you lose a lot of – it's not like precision surgery, you know. But one of the things he certainly, I felt very keenly, was his contempt for weakness and contempt for fear. And, you know, those are really appropriate, normal human responses, especially in a child. And, you know, I was very much trying to be like him, like a good Polish girl. There's such a thing for Poles to be brave, like it's, you know. Mm. And there's also that classic second generation migrant experience, you know, that all those expectations that you'll be successful and achieve academically and all that sort of thing. And that was very much the case with, you know, it was an interesting confluence, actually, of the medical training and the... it's interesting, isn't it, that an assassin wants to be a healer you know, a doctor, a lifesaver, you know, two sides of the same coin, or, you know, something going on there. I don't know exactly, but kind of interesting,
This whole push about being brave and also being a winner. I mean, he was really into sport and he really pushed you into it. Tell me about the tennis years.
Oh, well, all I have to say really is Eastern European father tennis coach, and I think that... I'm not saying Demir Dokic, but there was... It was weird. As I say in the book, you know, every family has an arena where its madness plays out, and ours, bizarrely, was tennis. But it's not surprising, you know, it is a zero-sum game, you know, kill or be killed. That tennis players will say that. That's the language they use. I mean, his father was a really, like, achieved quite a high level of proficiency in, which I think, Greco-Roman wrestling, which I just think is the gayest thing ever. Like, so, it's hilariously gay. But in Eastern Europe, it's like the really macho, like, they're like the guys, you know. And he, like, wrestled the Polish world champion and all that. So he was an extremely disciplined man. My father was like that, very sporty, very disciplined. And so we were expected to sort of train like champions, while he would also had this constant commentary of telling you why you were going to be second rate or third rate if you were lucky. But the whole thing was freighted with this strange thing, because he told me when I was 9 that I had no killer instinct. And people are always saying, oh, you know, when did your father tell you that he was an assassin? And I'm like, well, I don't know. It's like, I don't even know when I realised there was no Santa Claus. But, you know, he probably told me when I was like in my late teens. But I always knew. Mm. We're like dogs, children particularly like dogs. We pick up on feeling states. And there was a merciless quality in him. And when he told me I had no killer instinct, I knew he did, because he would finish me off, as he put it. And I reacted against that. And I used to then, actually, when I was winning, I would be so overwhelmed with compassion for my opponents, I'd start crying and then I'd lose. But it was there. I could feel it playing out. And so, you know, it really took years of therapy to sort of understand just all of what was playing out, you know, not just on the tennis court, but in all of life, you know. And I think that's why people have responded, I suspect, very strongly to the book, because those two world wars are global conflicts. Mm. It's all rolling through us all. Now, in terms of geopolitics, it goes on, but also emotionally, you know, the trauma that sort of just continues to reverberate through. Mm. So I kind of wanted as much as possible to give words to that silence that often separates people who are traumatized from the rest of their families.
Towards the end of the tennis years, you began to succumb to what you called the genetic curse of fat. Tell us about playing Russian roulette with hunger, as you describe it.
My father was a tubby boy. His mother was overweight. And then during the war, he lost all the weight, because, of course, they were on starvation rations. And then when he was in the POW camp, he came out of that svelte, very handsome, sort of slightly Dirk Bogart-ish. And for the rest of his life, he used to starve himself. And that was what he encouraged me to do. I think most overweight people actually have a very complex relationship to deprivation and hunger. I don't know exactly what's playing out there. But, yeah, certainly I've sort of, you know, tried the whole starvation thing. That didn't really work. You know, I don't know what the hell does work. Who does?
Do you think that the whole weight thing was driven by what you call your social identity threat, your realisation that you might be gay?
I think there was definitely that sense of body armour and covering up in some regards. I think overweight is enormously complex, and it's a combination of biochemistry, genetics, environment. But I think there is definitely an emotional component too, and certainly there was comfort eating. And it was a way for me to sort of hide in a flesh armour, in a sense, because that was a terrifying realisation. And it was a realisation, I mean, in Australia, you know, you have people who are 6th, 7th generation Australians, and they've never had a conflict on their own soil, apart from Aboriginal experience notwithstanding. And so there's a very different sensibility for those of us who are migrant populations who carry that awareness. Mm. And that's, you know, that kind of European pessimism about the mob and what can happen. And And so that pressing up against this awareness that I was part of a minority group, which, you know, when I was growing up, it was illegal. It was considered a psychiatric illness and it was frequently conflated with paedophilia. So it was the most disgusting thing you could be. And, you know, for God's sake, in Australia, we still can't get marriage equality through. So that sort of, you know, cauldron of all of those things bumping up against one another was very frightening. And I think that eating was one of the few things I could be sure of.
Just to sort of fast forward slightly, you really began to explore your sexuality after you'd left school. You were at university and you were working in a women's refuge.
Yeah.
That must have felt very liberating.
Oh, it was incredible, actually. And I felt really strong, you know, I felt very strong in that identity. But then again, I found the ideology of it. It's that very much comes from my mother, that subversive streak in my nature, that any kind of forced conformity, I tend to kick against it. But that was an amazing experience and very important. It was very early in the days of the women's refuge movement in Australia. And being around other lesbians is a great cure for internalised homophobia. That was great. But then once I moved out of that and I ended up moving into performing and my career became increasingly mainstream, I felt really sort of untethered and cut off from that, actually.
Mm. Well, let's talk about that early comedy work, because it seems to have been very male-dominated.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, it still is. I mean, Kath and Kim and Big Girls Blouse are still really the only. We thought there'd be this sort of flood of other female performers, because Kath and Kim came out of Gina Riley and Jane Turner, and I did an all women sketch comedy show called Big Girls Blouse, and that's where I created the character of Sharon Strzelecki. And we sort of thought that we'd be opening the floodgates and other women would pour through, but I think Australia is very, you know, it's a funny country. Like, there's 72% of the population are pro gay marriage, but we can't get it through. But it's a blokey culture, and there's very few high profile gay people, actually. Like, I'm one of the few, to be honest. When you sit down and look at it, you go, oh my God, this kind of me and not a lot of others. Mm. When we were starting out in comedy, there was really that perception that women aren't funny, but that's here too. I mean, Christopher Hitchens famously said, you know, women aren't funny. And a male colleague of ours was asked, you know, do you think women are funny? And he sort of sucked his teeth and went, not really, no.
You had to fight to be taken seriously as a writer on that show. And in fact, you say you learnt three important writing lessons.
Yeah, well, don't compare it to Shakespeare. Get the tools of the trade, have a laptop of one's own, like, because all the boys had laptops and we used to write freehand in a cafe, so no one took us seriously. I can't remember what the third one was. Something else is clearly not that important. But, yeah, I mean, we had to sort of push beyond those barriers. Mm. And then, of course, Kath and Kim went on to become the most successful comedy in Australian television history. So, women aren't funny, apparently.
But you had to be really persuaded into television, didn't you? I mean, do you think it was your sexuality that was holding you back?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I love the mainstream. I love the idea of communicating with huge numbers of people. I love the logistics and I love calibrating the message and trying to get it across. And I'm a populist in many regards, but I was really nervous about how all that would go. And there was it was a really primal thing. It wasn't like a very conscious thing in some ways. And I find when I speak to Jewish second generation Holocaust survivors in Australia or Poles, and I talk about the mob and the fear of the mob and the way those things can turn, that's like wired into me. Mm. So anything that, in a way, I think I was facing that fear. Like, I've ended up going right into the Colosseum, you know, where it's thumbs up or thumbs down. And I'm kind of glad that I did that. But there is that really, you know, you're raised to understand that things can take a terrible, terrible turn.
You did a lot of travelling, and at one point you took your parents back to their respective homes. And that was when you visited Auschwitz. You described the Poles as custodians of hell on earth.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really, you know, it's a really, I know Stephen Fry, and I'm being very careful at this because I thought his apology actually was one of the most beautiful, heartfelt, genuine apologies when he made a comment about, you know, of course, Poland is where the death camps are. And the Poles were so stung by that because, you know, to them it was something that was imposed on them. And the whole issue of Polish anti-Semitism is enormously complex. And in fact, the history of the Poles, when you go back further, it's like a sad treatise on the demise of tolerance and democracy, because it was known as the Jewish paradise. Mm. And it just has this unfortunate geography. It was invaded by, you know, Germans and Poles. And anyway, that's a whole other story. But Yeah, I think it's an incredible, you know, what a thing to, that's the thing that you're known for, you know, the, being the home of the death camps. And, you know, the Poles are very aware of that. And I really wanted to go to Auschwitz. And my father didn't feel the need because he lived Warsaw effectively, you know, towards the end of the war. They brought in the most brutal troops from Eastern Europe. And it was kind of like a concentration camp in itself, like the site of what had been the ghetto. It was terrible. So he didn't feel the need to see it, but I sort of felt the need to bear witness. But Mum was just horrified. She couldn't handle it. And hers was, of course, a normal human response, whereas I sort of felt the pressure to kind of slip into a lockstep, almost dissociated experience with my father. So
the brilliant thing about this book is that, as you say, it's not by any stretch of the imagination a celeb memoir. There's no gossip. You talk about Auschwitz and then there's Babe.
Yeah, and that's life, isn't it? You know, I mean, for you know, that was the thing, is that, I mean, I also sort of wanted to take the pressure off, the foot off the pedal a bit, to just give people a breather from it. But that is actually exactly the way that it unfolded in life. Mm. You know, you go from those experiences. And I mean, people really know me, especially in Australia, for comedy, but I've always felt like I'm very in touch with those feelings of both sadness and joy. So, so then Babe, which was an extraordinary experience, it really tested my patience working with animals. I get it now, like 98 takes after. You
know. And they were all separate pigs, I understand.
Yeah, there were 47 different. So the pig would get tired and they'd just bring on a new pig, whereas I just had to keep working with all this, you know, and you'd get your line right and the pig's wandering around out of the back of frame.
Dear. Of course, that led to Hollywood. But again, once again, you've got this whole thing of, well, I don't want my sexuality out there. I don't want to be mega famous. You kind of lost that opportunity in a way at that time.
Look, I'm one of those shockingly ambivalent people. I have a very genuinely ambivalent relationship to fame, in that, you know, it's useful and it can be fun, but and I probably have learnt to roll with it a lot more, and I'm also shy, you know, which is a thing. I think many performers are extroverted introverts, that ambiverts they call us now. But yeah, I kind of blew that one. I had this amazing opportunity, but I really, at that time, this was before Ellen DeGeneres had come out, and I just could not see a way to make it work that I could, without becoming completely sort of cut off from my sexuality, you know, and becoming this creature of fame, which I didn't want to do. I wanted to become more real, not less real.
But you did come out to your family eventually.
I did, yeah. I mean, I'd come out to my sister, you know, my brother years before. And then in my early 30s, I came out to my mum and dad, and they were gorgeous, absolutely lovely. I'm very lucky, because it's not like that for everyone. Mm. But yeah, it was kind of hilarious too. But Mum going, and I'm saying, so, you know, I go home on a Sunday evening. She's going, so what, you know, this is an interesting time for a visit. And I said, oh, yeah, I want to chat. She said, ooh, we love to chat. Like, no idea what sort of conversation she was in for.
But they were really compassionate, weren't they? And
they were beautiful. Yeah. They were beautiful. And it was, that's a terrible thing. I mean, one of the things I say in the book is that for LGBTQI people, the difference from other minorities is that you are a minority of one within your own family. Like in other minority groups, the family shares the minority status. So you can benefit from the collective wisdom of how to negotiate the world as a minority. But when you're LGBTQI and now A as well, you're completely on your own within your family, within your primary survival unit. And to be realizing that as a small child frequently is terrifying. That's that identity threat. Yeah. Realizing that the very who you are might cause your family to turn against you, because sexuality is one of those things that's about disgust, and people don't always have control over that. You know, they can feel revulsion, and it can be irrational. So I've known people who come from families, they're very sort of small L liberal, and they've turfed their kids out of the family. Mm. So less and less that happens. But certainly when I was younger, it was not uncommon at all. That's why gay people created our own sense of what a family is, which was friends, because we had to.
You finally then wanted to nail down your father's identity, and you got a video camera, and you went and just asked him all the questions that you wanted to know. I mean, he was quite old and ill by then, wasn't he?
Oh, he wasn't so ill then. He'd had heart attack and he'd had a recurrence of cancer, because he got cancer a year after we moved to Australia. No, he was reasonably well at that time, but he was in his, I think it was like late 60s, maybe 70, no, 70-odd. And he said, I will speak of this once and once only, because he had really very rarely spoken about it, even with the other Poles, because there's a large Polish diaspora community in Poland. But none of them had ever heard of his unit because it was top secret. And it wasn't until these history books started coming out with pictures of him that everyone's going, oh, okay, that's what Zbyszek was talking about, you know, or Peter, as everyone called him. It started then, and then after that he would talk about it more often because he realised that people weren't judging him, you know, because I think when he first came to Britain, like, no one, it was such an extreme thing, you know, to be doing, and the Nazi occupation of Poland was a very brutal one. The occupations of the various countries weren't the same. I mean, Hitler treated the Danes and the Dutch very differently from, he hated the Poles, he hated the Slavs, you know. And even within his own country, because of when the communists came in, they judged his unit very harshly, you know, and they judged the resistance fighters very harshly. And he was sick to death of being on this roller coaster of public opinion about the worth of not just his actions, but himself as a human being. So, yeah, he told me all about it, and some of it I could hear and other bits I couldn't. And in a way, the book is me going back like a detective, re-examining the clues and rehearing things that I couldn't. It was 13 years before I could even watch those films. It was so distressing to me.
After his death, you were, I suppose, looking for absolution for him.
Yeah.
And in particular from the Dalai Lama.
Yeah, I did. I just wanted to, well, it's that pacifist thing, isn't it? You know, because Dad, you know, he went through this whole journey of when he was younger, he said it was very black and white. These people were traitors and, you know, they were either Poles or they weren't. And then as he got older, he said it becomes very grey. And he said, I don't know what pressure they were under, you know. And he used to, when he got to Britain and, you know, I mean, he was like, his brain wasn't even fully formed when he was doing that, you know what I mean? So when he married my mother, he used to beat his breast and say, I'm so guilty. It really, I think if you're basically a good person, killing people, even if it's for the right reason, it don't come easy, you know, and it takes a toll. And I think it ate away at him. And there's that pacifist dilemma of, you know, I mean, I'm really drawn to Buddhism and the Dalai Lama, and I've met him twice now, and he's an extraordinary man. I emceed for him in Melbourne, actually, when he was down there. But, you know, how far does pacifism go? Like, I might not kill to save my own life, but if I saw someone killing a child, as my father did, well, I would probably kill that person. You know, what's the, you know, that's the pacifist dilemma. So I mean, I did. I wanted to say to the Dalai Lama, if you were in my father's situation and you saw that, what would you do? But, of course, you can't say that to the Dalai Lama. So.
You did the television show Who Do You Think You Are? And I don't want to go into that too much because actually that's really the kind of denouement of the book in a way.
Yeah.
But after that, you came out to the world. And I wonder what prompted that.
It was a couple of things. I was ready, you know, I was older. I'd done a lot of therapy and worked on my own internalised homophobia, which is a really important journey for people to do because if you come out at the wrong time, it can not go well for you necessarily. But also the marriage equality debate just really got my dander up. I was so angry about it. And I don't even know if I'm capable of marriage, but I just think that we should have the same rights. But it was also definitely informed by that closer through Who Do You Think You Are, because I went into my Polish family, you know, what they'd done. And that sort of history, that because there is a very strong Polish history of tolerance and of my family had Jewish friends. They hid Jewish people. They did it because it was the right thing to do. And when you ask them why they did it, they would just simply say they had no further understanding it was the right thing to do. And I think that's the history working through them. And that was working through me, and there just was this voice going, it's the right thing to do, it's the right thing to do. And I just couldn't, I had no idea how it would affect my career because there is a certain conservatism in Australia, but I just felt I had to do it. And thank God I did, you know, it was so empowering in a way that I would never have anticipated. And, you know, one of my struggles has been, you know, in the shadow of my father and my grandmother's courage, I've always felt like such a shitty coward, you know. And I realised I had to forgive myself that, you know, feeling fear is actually, despite the Polish paradigm, feeling fear is actually normal. But I realised too that being brave is not a state of mind. You become brave through doing something brave, and that it becomes a feedback loop and it changes you. And it really changed me, and I consequently felt incredibly empowered and so much then braver in turn. So, yeah, I'm so glad I did it.
You write in the book, what makes you a writer is having the balls to call yourself one and a computer. You knew you could write comedy, although the blank page always frightened you. You had the bravery to go for that. But did you always feel that this book was coming?
No, didn't see that at all, no. And then I started writing and I went, this is a really crass comparison. You know when a dog farts and it goes, oh, did I do that? I sort of feel like that's what this book is. I was like, oh, seriously, did I do that? And it kind of, but it also, there was a thing that as I was writing it, and I've got to tell you, I think this is a really British thing, a love of language and a love of words, you know.
Well, you quote so many authors. I mean, there's everyone from Lessing to William James.
I'm a dipper and a skimmer, though. I don't always read cover to cover. Don't be fooled. But, you know, I just, this powerful love of language started to express itself. And I wanted to write the most beautiful book I could possibly write and the most affecting book, because when you're writing a story about people that no one cares about, which is the Poles, really, and their story, and I think it is an important story because that, you know, within that sort of victim, persecutor, rescuer paradigm that was going on with the Germans, the Poles and the Jews, I think their story is an important element of that. And I wanted to honour them. I wanted to honour my family, really. And I think we all have different traumas and different tragedies, but I think there's a very powerful way that we can connect through that sort of sorrow in a way that reduces us to the basic elements of who we are and just obliterates difference. And that was kind of where I was hoping to get to with it.
I think you absolutely succeeded.
Oh, thank you.
Has Australia gained a great writer but lost a great actress? Will you continue to do both?
Oh, I have to, because writing doesn't pay, so I've got to keep the day job.
Magda, thank you so much. Magda Szubanski with her memoir, Reckoning. It's published by Text Publishing in Australia. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Claire Urban and Maria Grinana. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.